Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Naked Reflections. The history of our attitudes to childhood is fascinating and distorted. With me to discuss aspects of childhood are Simon Baron Cohen, Lindsay Burton, and Julian Stanley. Let's hear a clip from Hannah Newton on The Naked Scientists. She's talking about Victorian theories of childhood.
One author wrote that children's brains are drowned and drunk with moisture and humours, and this is why children weren't very rational. And it also accounted for their emotional tendencies. Children cry very easily and get very happy and very sad very quickly. And that emotional fluctuation was put down to the fact that the rational soul, the part of the soul responsible for reason, was slightly incapacitated by all this liquid. And for this reason, children's brains were thought to be like wax. They were very impressionable, which made them peculiarly capable of learning and also made them a time in their life really when their personality was thought to be formed.
Some premonitions of modern neuroscience there. Si, I'd like to sort of move back to the earlier stages of childhood and the development of the personality. That's an area of your expertise. What's the latest research telling us?
I think that the latest research is still in line with some of the very classic old research.
That's so encouraging.
So, you know, a lot of the kind of founding ideas came from a psychologist called John Bowlby.
Yeah.
Who worked at the Tavistock Clinic.
Attachment theories.
Particularly around the concept of attachment and the importance of having a secure attachment with a caregiver, often a parent, and, you know, hopefully for most kids, more than one caregiver, you know, two parents or a grandparent, so that the child is getting a sense of being loved and valued and being important right from the beginning. And, you know, that was revolutionary in its day back in the 1950s. The idea that, you know, that children take, you know, they take stock of these, of what they're receiving from adults. Previously, it might have been acceptable to send your child off to boarding school or send your child off for significant amounts of time, but actually, it was understood from Bowlby's work that those kinds of separations can have a big emotional impact. And I think, you know, the new neuroscience is supporting that idea. There's work coming out of the Anna Freud Centre in London, for example.
Excellent work.
Part of UCL. Just kind of documenting that the first year of life, a lot of the kind of circuitry that's being laid down in the brain is the result of the quality of emotional relationships that that child is receiving.
And so really what you're saying is from the late 50s to the present day, we still have the same views of childhood.
Well, I think we've got new tools, but some of the ideas have stood the test of time.
And would you say that the personality of the child who becomes the adult, that's formed at this very, very early stage, or is that developed as they go in through the early years through to primary school?
It's not that, you know, that the early years are the only time when experiences are important. But if you look at people who develop quite significant psychiatric difficulties in later life, and look back at their childhoods, there is a big link. So something like borderline personality disorder, people who have real problems in regulating their emotions, forming trust with other people, and being able to have kind of stable relationships. A very significant majority, something like 80%, suffered from neglect or even abuse in their early childhoods.
Julian, is this something that you find in the work that you do when you're working with teachers, that when they kind of unpack it, if there's a problem with a child in the classroom, it goes back to the family or goes back to the that environment?
Yes, many teachers spot signs of difficulty at home, let's put it like that. And often where there's very strong relationships between teachers and the parents of a pupil, there can be an alliance, and that alliance can be very, very powerful and helpful. And today in schools, often they assign other teachers to coach or look after or look out for particular children or groups of children who are displaying symptoms of difficulty in terms of their behaviour or their interactions with other children. And so that's a very powerful tool, actually, because often children are very isolated because they don't want to be disloyal to their parents, and you only know what you know. You don't know anything different. You're brought up at home. You assume that the way you are being parented is the way to be parented.
We've focused a lot in this part of the conversation about emotional experiences as determining, you know, whether you grow up with a sense of security and self-esteem or not. But there's another whole chunk of children who struggle, not because they didn't receive plenty of love, but because of so-called neurodevelopmental factors. You know, it's partly genetic. And how the brain gets wired up.
So you're talking autism here.
And autism, kids disorders. Who are kind of late to talk, you know, so most kids are sort of developing language without much effort. You know, that children are saying their first words by 12 months and whole sentences by their second birthday. You know, but there are a percentage of children who don't develop language and social skills, not because of lack of love or lack of support from their families, but for genetic, partly genetic reasons. And they need support too. You know, they need to be picked up. So we shouldn't just always be focusing on what have the families not been providing. You know, there are just differences.
That's a really important
point. There are
point.
Differences in the population. You know, and some kids talk early, some kids talk late. And the kids who are talking late may struggle in things like turn-taking or participating in classroom activities and so forth. They may need extra support and even a diagnosis of a disability.
Well, autism was once refrigerator mother syndrome, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Decades ago.
Yeah, probably not since about the 1960s. Yeah. So I think most people now recognise that it's a biomedical condition. Mm. So there's more awareness. But whether there's enough services and support is still, you know, at play.
I'm interested in where the phrase came from.
The idea that autism was caused by emotionally distant mothers, which has been completely debunked as nonsense at this point. But I would point out that the parent is still a really important figure. You know, obviously funding cuts and resources not being available notwithstanding, you know, it is still the parent that is the first responder and the mediator of any resources, you know, state provided, privately provided for a child who needs them.
I would agree. But, you know, parents themselves can experience stress. Mm. And so they may themselves need support. Mm. So if we take autism, for example, you know, it's now kind of quite clear that parents of autistic kids experience a lot of stress if their child isn't sleeping and the parents have to try to get to work the next day. You know, high rates of marital breakdown in families where there's an autistic child. So although we should be turning to parents to kind of sort of mediating the support for the child, I think we need to also make sure that there is family support.
Yeah, and I think that links in, doesn't it, to the notion of communities and the importance of communities, whether you're involved in a local group, whether you're involved in a religious community, not being isolated is particularly important in being able to kind of make some sense of difficult situations.
Oh, sorry, Lindsay, I thought you were looking.
No, just reflecting. My brother's actually autistic. Mm-hmm. I'm reflecting on the experience of growing up as a sibling and experience of accessing respite, not care, but respite activities for my parents and
exactly.
for myself.
So, you know, so you do have that family perspective, including the impact on you as a sibling.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But coming back to this idea of destigmatizing and of raising awareness, there's an interesting new word that's out there, which is called neurodiversity. Neurodiversity really just means that we're all very different, but our brains are very different. There isn't a single way to either be normal, by the same token, if you're not conforming to some notion of normality, it means that you're abnormal. We're kind of throwing away that very binary, kind of almost mythical notion of the normal child, and we're recognizing that there are many ways for children to develop. So that's neurodiversity.
But do we not need some sense of what normality is, even if it's a myth, even if it's a breadth to what normal is? Because we certainly, taking it beyond the question of childhood, we live with a myth. The myth of the nation, the myth of a community, the myth of society. So isn't there something that you quite dangerous about saying there's no such thing as normal?
So I think that normal implies we should all be the same. And what neurodiversity gives us is just like we think about diversity in other parts of society. You know, we're now thinking about diversity of brains and about difference. So I don't think that's dangerous. I mean, I think you're right that we still need to have some notion of morality. We're not saying that there's no kind of boundaries on what counts as moral behaviour. So we still need to be thinking about what would be a good society.
So really it's about living with difference, that we're all different, but how we live together.
Precisely.
With difference.
Yeah. So whereas the autistic child, even before we had a term like autism, might have been the child who was bullied for being different. You know, today I think, you know, children in the mainstream are recognizing differences are just part of any community. Some people may struggle with certain things, and the idea of picking on a person just because they're different is no longer acceptable.
It's also worth noting, if we pull back and consider, you know, human society as a whole, and we think about norming, the adult is normed and the child is ultimately othered. It's one of the last power binaries that we don't really talk about. It plays a huge role in children's literature theory. The big fancy word for it is adonormativity, the idea that we norm based on age. So in that sense, the autistic child and the neurotypical child are actually not that far apart from each other, in that they're both sort of put into this othered category by adults who sit around doing podcasts about them.
And can you give us an example in literature? You talked about what sort of texts or books might you be thinking of?
All of them. If they're written for children, they are sort of inherently adonormative. If you think about children's literature, it is written by adults. It is published by adults. It's marketed by adults. It's sold and purchased by adults. Children are receptive of it. And you have overt examples, you know, Little Pretty Pocketbook I mentioned earlier, but tons of educational books, you know, very intentionally done up for educational purposes. But even Harry Potter, you know, the more popular books for enjoyment can't help but reinforce adult normativity, adult authority in subtle ways.
So can you see the development of children's literature written by children for children?
So this is actually a very contemporary discussion. It's interesting. With the advent of the internet and this thing called fan fiction, you actually have a greater percentage of children, typically, you know, preteens or teens, writing for each other. You know, it's not traditional publishing. It's outside of you know, any sort of money-making avenue, but it's thriving. It's a thriving community. So in a sense, it is growing.
We're talking about blame and responsibility this week, and let's face it, there's plenty to go round. My guests are Professor Bertram Marlay from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, a specialist in social cognition, moral psychology, and human-robot interaction, and a regular contributor, Dr. Kitty Alone, research fellow here at the Wolf Institute, with specialism in the cognitive science of religion and morality and moral transference. Well, welcome both. Could it be that our inability to call out bad behaviour generates certain frustration and then into vile abuse that is spewed out in our social media? Kitty?
Well, as we were talking about sort of the evolution of small-scale groups, the internet is sort of something evolutionarily novel in terms of human sort of existence. And Yes. So it's difficult to know where this vitriol that you see spilling out from the depths of the internet comes from. I mean, it's been argued that a lot of it is to do with anonymity. So we are social creatures. Our reputation is incredibly important. Without being accountable, when you can hide your personhood, when you're anonymous, people are much more likely to engage in immoral or unethical behaviours. And it kind of acts almost like a licence. So you're hidden behind your keyboard and you can write vitriol and you can write really terrible, toxic things because you don't have to be accountable. You've got those reputational concerns removed. It's interesting that you said a lack of blame. I mean, some people would argue that the internet is sort of becoming a blame playground, if you like. So you go on Twitter these days and inevitably somebody will have said something that someone finds offensive. So there's a strange dichotomy, I think, that on the one hand, there's this reluctance to publicly blame unless you have warrant, as Bertrand can talk more about. But there is also this sort of hyper blame that seems to be something that associates itself with the internet and this online community of people who are sort of morally safeguarding the internet. Yeah, it's interesting to hear what you think, Bertram.
I mean, we're only beginning to understand the full dynamic of especially social media. You know, some newspapers stopped having comment sections because people got into such vile discussions that they constantly had to delete every other comment. But I think one of the ways in which we can think about it is that this isn't any more blame. It isn't blame in the sense that I show my respect by expressing my criticism because I assume that you actually have a shared norm and value system. And by criticizing, I then hope that we both repair whatever relationship we had. There is no relationship between whether it's anonymous or even name-carrying individuals. They are removed from each other. They see no facial reactions of horror, of anger. There are no costs to overexpressing, to overblaming, as we are beginning to use this term. Whereas in reality, overblaming is actually a norm violation. If I accuse you of something that you didn't do, or I blame you strongly for a small violation, if we are part of a group of friends or of colleagues, that would not be acceptable. Because there are costs. We know in our group, if everybody starts overblaming everybody, that group would break down. On the internet, these groups are newly constituted each time a new article receives commentary. And on Twitter, there are followers, but those are not groups. They're not interacting. They are reacting. And so I think the lack of costs is one thing. And I think Ed is right. Whatever frustration and aggression you might have carried into the situation, you then are free to express it in some way. And people don't realize that really expressing aggression leads to more aggression, not only in the other who responds, but also in ourselves. So this limitless permission to express, I think, is really quite problematic.
Let me take you back to Geoffrey Howe's famous resignation speech over 30 years ago, when he spoke of Margaret Thatcher's bruising negotiating stance over the European Community budget, and he said, and I quote, "It's rather like sending your opening batsman to the crease only to find, as the first balls are being bowled, that their bats have been broken before the game by the team captain." Now, the reason I quote it, is it just a matter of rhetoric? Does the sort of quaint cricketing simile disguise the criticism? Does it intensify it? Have we lost, based on what you were just talking about, Kitty and Bertram, have we lost the ability that Geoffrey Howe showed to be directly critical without being insulting?
If you can strike a balance between justifiably criticising your own team, if it were, in pursuit of the greater good, it can come across very well. It's a very difficult game to play, but if you can express some degree of self-reflection, self-criticism, it opens you up to others as being a much more trustworthy person.
Yeah, and one thing we really sort of hate is hypocrisy, where somebody blames somebody else, though having done the same thing maybe in the past, or does it in parallel. And I think what's so interesting, I had to read the transcript that you referred to, Ed, and he keeps saying, "my honorable friend." And I think there really is and was a relationship between them. So to show respect is to criticize lightly, maybe with metaphor, maybe indirectly. But to criticize also means that you still are friends. That is, by not ignoring the other, rejecting and dismissing the other, but rather taking on that difficult task of, I criticize and I need you to know how I feel about you. And of course, also there's a whole public audience that he had to handle. But I think there's something quite profound about the idea that respect and criticism go together. And if you criticize without respect, the criticism loses its moral power and it becomes more fight rather than criticism.
There's an element of Shakespeare's Mark Antony and Brutus, you know, the honourable Brutus. Do you remember? And so there's this relationship, but the word honourable is not a positive. It becomes more and more vindictive. When you read it, it's black and white. There's not the colour. When you watch it, if you watch a YouTube a version of that resignation speech, it's incredibly powerful. There's not a lot of love there. That love has been broken asunder. And maybe because they were close, Bertram, it actually feeds into this anger and this blame.
Yes, and I think that just as there is some evidence that blaming in a more restrained way can maintain relationships, as we said, in small groups in particular, but also in individual relationships, interpersonal relationships, there is a form of blame turning into punishment, and punishment ends relationships. If I no longer am willing to engage in the interaction of criticism, maybe remorse, forgiveness, and then moving on, but if I punish as a person or as an institution, there is no relationship anymore. I mean, this is why it's so detrimental that we have institutionalized criticism and powerful punishment. And it almost seems, even though historically the arc goes down, at least in the US in the last few decades, the arc has gone up again, intensity and frequency of punishment. There is no relationship between the punisher and the punished. If the state punishes, and whether it's incarceration or in the worst case, the death penalty in a few US states, there's nothing there. There's nothing left. And if then the person returns from prison and is also not reintegrated with the community, let alone with the state, you really have no functional future together and even alone. So this is, I think, one of the really sad changes in larger and larger societies. That criticism is not really a tool anymore, but it becomes punishment replacing criticism and blame.
Well, we're coming towards the end, and I'm going to give you each the opportunity to own up to some recent misdeed now in a form of, you don't have to offer a confession, but, you know, are you able to acknowledge a responsibility for some act for which you have rightly been blamed or perhaps no one's blamed you at all?
Bertram, you first.
Sure. I would rather not admit to a misdeed without my lawyer present. But I'll tell you something that my wife and I have adopted. It's a practice that goes as follows. When we have an argument, and it could be about claims of fact. One says, no, it was 4 years ago. And the other says, no, that was 2 years ago. And we all know that we can get into these very confident statements and claims. What we have agreed to and really do now quite reliably is when then reality comes out, it was really 4 years ago. The one who was wrong, who wrongly confidently claimed the other thing, has to say, you were right and I was wrong. And we literally have to use those words. And I'll tell you, it still stings a little to have to say that. But it is powerful because the other almost is invited immediately to forgive. And any kind of disagreement is just that, disagreement over facts. That can also be about somewhat more morally tinged and not just factual disagreements. So I think this is, we really needed to practice that. It was not easy the first time. So whatever misdeeds there are, or what small disagreements there are, being able to say that and practice saying it, I think goes a little bit towards that reconciliation and also reinstating our own self-image, but still being able to admit.
Well, being completely blameless. I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but when I was a teenager, I just passed my driving test. And I drove it out and I'd sort of, you know, got really overconfident and tried to park it and ended up scratching my dad's new paintwork. I drove it home, parked it in the carport, and he saw it and inevitably went absolutely ballistic. And he thought it was, he blamed my mum for doing it. He was, oh, your bloody mother's done this again, blah, blah, blah. And I said nothing. I didn't own up. And to this day, I still feel guilty about it. Not guilty enough to actually tell her, though. But maybe if I just sort of go through the ritualized confession, maybe that'll alleviate some of my guilt rather than actually trying to make interpersonal amends. Who knows?
Kitty, you're pardoned. That's all for this week. Thanks to my guests, Bertram Marley and Kitty Alone. We'd like to hear from you at nakedreflections@wolf.cam.ac.uk. Let us know where we're going wrong or what we're getting right. If you'd like to catch up with our back catalogue, which includes episodes on Einstein, nudge theory, racism and many, many more, you can find them and subscribe to the Naked Reflections podcast wherever you access your podcasts or at nakedscientists.com/reflections. I'll be back next week with some more guests.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.